Sometimes when I talk to a woman about her career, she is unsure if she wants to go to sea. She's concerned about family planning, what her career will look like long term, and if she'll be able to transition to a shoreside role when she wants to. I always encourage women to go ahead and get that operations experience on the water. It will benefit your career, and you never know what's going to happen. Today's episode is about that, not knowing what's going to happen, taking those big leaps, and being pretty surprised by what your career can turn into. This is the Women Offshore Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Cedeno, a mariner and founder of Women Offshore. Women Offshore is a 501c3 nonprofit organization supporting a diverse workforce on the water. Have you thought lately about what risks you want to take in your career? Are there any big jumps that you want to make, but maybe you're nervous about it or you're unsure? I get it. It's hard to take these big jumps. However, there can be great surprises on the other end when you make that landing into a new role. Kimberly Saxton is our guest today, and she is a graduate of the United States Merchant Marine Academy. She worked at sea as a marine engineer for a tanker company and an offshore drilling company. And then in 2016, she made a big leap. She moved to a shoreside role to work for SpaceX as a systems integration and test engineer on the Dragon spacecraft. She was in that role for a couple years and then made another change where she moved to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory to work with NASA. Today, you're going to hear about her career, her experiences from being a cadet at the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy to what it has been like to work on space technology. There are skill sets and things that she learned at sea that she's benefited from. And I think you will be very surprised and inspired by her career. Welcome, Kim, to the Women Offshore Podcast.
Hey, Ali. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So please start out by sharing your background and what inspired you to work offshore.
Sure. So growing up, my dad was working for Lockheed Martin. And before that, he had served in the Air Force for 20 years and retired as a colonel. Growing up, I wanted to be a lot of things, but I wasn't really sure exactly what. Depending on the year, it varied from being a psychologist to maybe a doctor or engineer. And so my dad was an engineer, but I really had no idea what he did since he had a top secret clearance with Lockheed Martin. I just knew that he managed computer engineers and worked on geostationary satellites. And when he graduated college, computer engineering, computer science weren't really even majors yet. And so instead, he majored in mathematics. And then later, he ended up getting his master's degree through the Air Force and had got his master's of science in computer engineering. And so as a kid, I have this memory of visiting the CIA headquarters at Langley. And as a kid, there was a dollhouse on display, and they had a game where they told us to try to find the hidden camera. So I had made my guess, and it turned out that there was a hidden camera disguised as a brick. And I don't know, that was just something really vivid to me growing up. So turns out I was planning to probably follow in his footsteps, but I still wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do in high school. So when I was in high school, I thought, you know, being a computer engineer, that sounded really abstract, and I wasn't really that interested in pursuing that route. But I really liked the idea that getting an engineering degree lays a solid foundation for you to branch out and specialize into something else later on. So in general, I knew that was the route I wanted to take. And I had grown up playing softball with my friend Sarah. And it turns out her older sister, Margie, was going to this federal service academy called Kings Point, the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy. I think Margie may have been in your class. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. She was one of my classmates. Yeah.
Very cool. And so playing softball with Sarah, her dad, Mr. Marino, he would always tell us about the academy in between games. He really should have gotten paid money for what he did as a recruiter. Anyway, so he would always tell me, Kim, it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. You get your education in either intermodal transportation or marine systems engineering in 3 years. It's a trimester system. And for one whole year, you get to travel the world. It's called the Sea Year Program. So most people go on average to visit 20 different countries. You can even visit Antarctica. Your education is completely free. And since it's a federal service academy, you just need to fulfill the obligation of serving in the Merchant Marine for 5 years, plus Navy Reserves for 7 years. Or you can instead choose to serve in any of the armed forces, such as Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, for 4 years. And that's it. And he said, of course, it'll be hard. You'll probably be one of the only females. There's like 10% or less in each class. But once you finish, you'll have that real world experience and an amazing alumni network. So, you know, we're still in high school. Both Sarah and I ended up taking a trip from Virginia to Long Island, New York. We took a tour of the academy. We met up with Margie and she told us all about it. Of course, everyone's in a khaki uniform and marching around, going to colors, sun class, etc. And I remember we walked into the cafeteria in our civvies and literally the entire room was looking at us. It felt really strange having what seemed like hundreds of mostly guys staring at you. But I recall after the tour, having walked around by the waterfront with a Kings Pointer training vessel and the dinghy and offshore team sailboats, learning about the different career options and just having the opportunity to travel the world all while learning as a cadet and getting a free education, that was so appealing for me. And I just had to go that route. And so I did.
Good. It sounds like you were inspired by some incredible people. And that set you on a course to have this career on the water. Are there any sea stories that stick out in your mind? Maybe one with a memorable lesson learned that you can share with us?
Sure. So as a cadet, there was one time that I almost missed the ship before heading to Antarctica. It's kind of a funny story. I was a cadet on a tanker ship that was ultimately going to Antarctica to deliver fuel to McMurdo Station. We had docked in Perth, Australia for bunkering before heading down the Southern Ocean. It was my first time, you know, going anywhere in Australia, and we had the whole day to go ashore. So I recall the sailing board had 5 p.m. written on it, let's say, and so the whole crew headed to the local Seaman Center and had planned to just hang out in the bar all day. And I thought that was so boring. I didn't want to spend my precious day in Australia drinking in a bar. I wanted to explore. So I was the only one who wanted to do anything, and I ended up calling a cab for myself and headed into town. Going to the Perth Zoo, I got to pet and get some photos with the kangaroo. I got to see a koala and a lot of other amazing Australian animals. I recall around 1 p.m. or so, I started to head back, and I wanted to make sure that I made it back to the ship in time. So I gave myself 2 hours before the sailing board had said, and the policy was, you know, don't show up any later than 1 hour before. So I had enough buffer. By the time I made it back to the Seaman Center, the whole crew was gone, and I thought that was kind of strange since, you know, we had 2 hours and change before sailing. And so I asked the bartender, the worker there, if he could call a cab back for me. And he just looked at me in shock. He said, wait, you're going to that ship? They bumped up the sailing time by 2 hours and they're about to leave in 30 minutes. So I thought,
oh no.
Yeah. I think I just stared at him in shock for a second or two. And then I just said, please take me back to the ship before they leave. There's no way I'm going to be able to rejoin if I miss this ship. So we hop in his car and he's speeding as fast as humanly possible without getting into an accident. And he literally drives me right up to the ship. At this time, the gangway was up. The crew saw me and they put down a pilot ladder for me to climb up. So I start climbing up the side of the ship on a pilot ladder. Of course, there's no tether or anything attached to me. I climbed up the 50 or so feet to the top of the ship's deck. And then a crewmate put out his arm. I grabbed on and he pulled me up and over the side of the ship. It was absolutely insane. I didn't get in trouble or anything either because, you know, they had bumped up the sailing time and I had no way of knowing. This was, you know, before having smartphones with international plans or anything like that. And so immediately after I got on, the ship got underway and we started sailing to Antarctica.
Yeah, that must have been so nerve-wracking. Like, it's the worst thing to think that you could be left behind, especially in a foreign country. And yeah. Wow, I'm glad you made it.
Thanks. I have one more, and I don't really know if there's a lesson to be learned, but it was just very memorable for me getting into Antarctica and then leaving it again. So being a cadet on that ship was part of the Operation Deep Freeze program. And each year, a couple of us USMMA midshipmen would be selected, you know, based on grades, sea year reviews, and number of sea days for a slot to work as a cadet on a ship that went to Antarctica. I'd worked so hard for this, and I was so ecstatic to get this opportunity. And so I first met the ship in Greece, and then traveled down through the Suez Canal with Navy folks on board, and we even had some giant 50 cals on the stern to deter pirates while we were going through the Suez Canal. So that was a great photo op. Then we headed to Diego Garcia and then Perth, which we just talked about. And next up was McMurdo, Antarctica. We had arrived January of 2011, if I recall correctly. And I know it had to be around that time frame because I actually turned 21 in Antarctica, which is pretty fun. And so just thinking back to that, Antarctica's summer season goes from October through February. During that time, the sun is always above the horizon. It just goes back and forth. So on the ship, when we were in port, we made sure to black out our windows in order to sleep at night. And so about 2,000 scientists and workers are in McMurdo Station during the summer months. And when the sun sets and stays set for the winter over, about 200 workers stay on the base during that time to maintain everything. And since it gets so dark during this time, and also in case of snowstorms or whiteouts, the workers will actually tie ropes from one building to the other for safety purposes. So when you're walking around there and you see ropes from one building to the other, that's why. And again, for my animal encounters, oh my God, I saw penguins in the wild for the first time. I saw a lot of seals, at least one orca. And there was a group of us on board the ship that took a trip to the Ross Ice Shelf in a truck with those giant snow tires installed. And we came upon a whole flock of penguins. I was able to get maybe 5 feet away from one of the penguins for a great photo op, but it's important to know not to get too close. If you or someone else does, they'll normally let you know by squawking really loudly, or worst case, they'll take a ride on their belly. When our ship was first docked at McMurdo, it's helpful to note that an accompanying icebreaker vessel in front of our ship was chopping up all the ice to allow us to safely enter. The workers actually had to use dynamite to blast away some of the ice that had built up at the makeshift pier before we docked. Our tanker ship was delivering all of the fuel for the entire base for that year. All the jet fuel, crude, diesel, you name it, came from that ship. When we were about to get underway to leave after we had finished bunkering everything, there was actually a part of the pier that had broken off and essentially trapped our ship from leaving. The workers there ended up staking multiple poles into the broken off ice section and then winched it away from our ship. That whole process took about a day or two, if I recall correctly. It was pretty crazy. And Antarctica is just so dynamic. The ice plates are constantly shifting around and the weather can vary from anywhere between, you know, negative 70 to just at freezing. Typically, though, on the peninsula in the summer months, temps will hang out around freezing. It's truly, you know, to me, one of the most isolated places on Earth. And I'm just so thankful that I was able to visit, since I don't think I would ever want to spend the money to try and vacation there.
Yeah, what a fantastic time as a cadet where you're learning and growing as a mariner for you to go to Antarctica and have this experience. I spent some time in Antarctica in my career. And I was on the other side. I was on the Ushuaia side of, you know, Argentina side, on the Antarctic Peninsula. And it's just such an amazing place. There's so much life down there, like what you're talking about with the penguins and the orcas. Mm-hmm. And it's just an amazing place. And I agree. It's a lot of money to go visit. And so if you can get on a ship and work and get paid to go see the area, it's just an experience unlike any other.
Exactly.
So in 2016, Kim, you joined SpaceX. What prompted you to make this move? What was the transition like for you to move to a shoreside role?
Sure. So I was actually called by a recruiter. It was kind of out of the blue. They had found me via LinkedIn and gave me a call and said, hey, you know, we're looking for engineers that, you know, maybe don't just have an aerospace background. We're looking for engineers that have a mechanical, electrical, marine background. Would you be interested in maybe doing a phone interview? And I said, wow, yeah, sure. Let's do it. And so I had a phone interview that turned into another phone interview and eventually an in-person interview. And, you know, at the time, I saw some signs of a downturn in the offshore industry, which we all know happens from time to time. And I was also looking for the next thing to move on to and, you know, was in the right place at the right time to kind of take on a grand new challenge. And so I would say the transition was really intense. Starting even from the interview with SpaceX, I had arrived at the SpaceX headquarters around 8 in the morning, and I want to say I left the building that day around 6 or 6:30 at night. And so that day was just jam-packed with morning orientation meeting, followed by me giving a 30-minute presentation to a room full of engineers and managers, explaining a recent project I had led and how this applies to the role I was interviewing for. After the presentation, different folks from around the room would ask me various questions, poking and prying to see if I really knew what I was talking about. I then went to this very tiny interview room, the kind that can hold like three people max. It also had a whiteboard on the wall, which I used quite a bit throughout that day. And I interviewed with, I think, 10 different hiring managers. Some were from Falcon, some were from Dragon, and they all asked me some really good and probing questions. I recall drawing out on the whiteboard how to perform a pressure test on propellant system, given that it had, you know, X, Y, and Z check valves. I remember also outwardly being very confident. Like in between interviews, when I was by myself, I would force myself to sit with my arms stretched back behind my head and sort of force myself to relax and be confident and cool. And it's kind of funny to mention now that we're looking back, is that even though I was exuding or trying to exude this confidence on the outside, I was so nervous, apparently, on the inside that after lunch, I had to go into a bathroom and I actually threw up before proceeding with all of my afternoon interviews. It was mental. Yeah. But I did fine. I did really well. I got the job. So
good.
That's all that
Congratulations.
Matters. And so I would say one of the most important lessons I learned during this transition from seagoing to shoreside employment was that when I had transitioned shoreside, moving from a drill ship to a large, you know, startup-y aerospace company like SpaceX, there was way less structure and not nearly as much direct oversight as you would typically have on board a ship. And so, you know, this meant that it was incredibly important to be self-disciplined about how you spend your time, how you spend your money, and prioritize what is really important in your work tasks. The transition was extremely challenging, and in all honesty, my time at SpaceX was to date the most challenging time of my life.
Yeah, I could see how the very regimented structure of working offshore would be different, and that mm-hmm. could be a challenge, but it sounds like you did very well, and I'm curious to know about what other skills helped you prepare for a career in space technology. What skills have you relied on? Is there anything from working offshore that you developed as a skill set that you rely on now?
Yeah, so I would definitely say, you know, first working with so many personalities offshore definitely helped when I first transitioned. Understanding how to work with people and different personalities was something that I did learn while offshore. And also just having that ability to innovate, quickly find solutions, and just being adaptable were all things that helped with my transition. And so I would say, you know, my education definitely laid a solid foundation, and the hands-on experience I had offshore was very useful to pick up some things quickly. I started out as an integration and test engineer for the Dragon capsules, which is part of NASA's Commercial Cargo and Crew program at SpaceX. And so I had started Cargo Dragon, which is also known as Dragon 1, which was going through a reuse strategy and implementation plan. And after that, I moved on to Demo 1, Dragon 2. And so this was the first uncrewed demonstration mission for sending astronauts to the ISS on private vehicles. This would be a historic first for the aerospace industry when astronauts first launched and successfully landed on a private vehicle. And as you may know, the Demo 2 capsule successfully splashed down just a few weeks ago with astronauts Bob Behnken and Doug Hurley on board. And fun fact, both of their wives are astronauts. So that's pretty cool to have some more women in the industry.
Yeah.
And I'm sure both their families are breathing easy now that the dad's back home. That was their nickname at SpaceX, the dads. But back to what skills were helpful for me in this initial transition, I was pretty confident with pressure testing and creating test procedures for pressure testing fuel and oxide systems. So, for example, for the Demo 1 vehicle, I had paired up with another engineer to build what was called the prop checkout rack, which was a data acquisition rack, which when you connect it to ground support equipment to a pneumatic system, you can, you know, open and close prop valves of your choice and essentially allow you to perform a full system pressure decay test, meaning that we would put a certain amount of helium into the prop lines, close the valves, and then use mass spectrometers to check the leak rate. And if you're wondering why use helium when it's really expensive, you could perhaps use nitrogen, which is so much cheaper. The answer to that is helium is a smaller atom, and, you know, therefore we can more precisely tell what the leak rate of a propulsion system is. So pressure testing and creating mechanical build and test procedures came to me pretty naturally just from working offshore as a marine engineer and someone who also worked with, you know, the subsea engineering department on board drill ships. I had taken apart and put back together almost everything on a ship and a drill ship. So understanding how to isolate power, pressure, read electrical and mechanical schematic diagrams, that was pretty straightforward for me and required very little self-learning. On the design side, however, that was not my strong suit and not something that school nor working as a marine engineer helps me with. But you can make the argument, like, why would it? It's not like the Merchant Marine Academy was built to create design engineers. Their purpose is to produce individuals capable of serving in our armed forces and merchant marine fleet in times of peace and war. And so anyway, I needed to teach myself NX, which is the professional version of AutoCAD. And I had Rourke's stress analysis book that always hung out right next to my keyboard. And I referenced that constantly when I was pulling late nights to just try and create tools and do various other things for this Demo 1 capsule. Another thing that I could handle all right when transitioning from working on tankers and drill ships to SpaceX was the crazy amount of hours. I would work easily 12 to 16 hours a day. The difference, of course, was that, you know, when I was working offshore, I was working that schedule 3 weeks on, and then I would have 3 weeks off for vacation. So I did work an insane amount of hours during my time at SpaceX. And after maybe a couple years of doing that, I was mentally and physically hurting pretty bad. It was a really intense time, but it was a really fruitful time of learning for me. And I'm just so supremely grateful for the opportunity to work with such intelligent and purpose-driven people.
Yeah, Kim, you're so impressive. And I am just floored talking with you and everything that you're doing. Now you're working with NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. What is that like?
Oh, it's amazing. It's absolutely incredible. I'm definitely the happiest I've ever been professionally and just also personally. And for those who aren't aware, JPL has designed, built, and operated the US's first satellite, Explorer 1. And so that was launched all the way back in 1958. That's kind of what they're first known for. Explorer 1 produced the first ever scientific result from space, discovered the Van Allen radiation belts. JPL has explored all of the solar system's planets, from Mercury all the way to Neptune, and Cassini, Juno, Voyager 1, and Voyager 2 are just a few notable spacecraft they've built in recent decades. They've designed, built, and operated all four of the successful rovers so far sent to the surface of Mars. Most recently, the Curiosity rover, and what I'm going to be talking about, my project, which is the Perseverance rover. So JPL is a federally funded research and development center managed for NASA by Caltech. It's a bit of a mouthful to say, but the way I understand it is essentially we're managed by Caltech, similar to how the MIT lab is managed by MIT. And all of the projects that we do are missions, go through a proposal and approval process, and are funded by NASA and Congress. And so for the past 2 years, I've been working with JPL on the Mars 2020 project, and it's been super fun and pretty amazing. And just to talk a bit more on, you know, what this mission is, the Mars 2020 mission is part of NASA's Mars exploration program. It's a long-term effort, robotic exploration of the red planet. The Mars 2020 mission addresses high-priority science goals for Mars exploration, including key astrobiology questions about the potential for life on Mars. And so for every Mars rover mission, NASA has done a naming contest where kids can submit an entry for what they think the rover should be named, along with an essay explaining why. That's how Curiosity got its name. And so this year, a boy named Alexander from actually my hometown in Fairfax, Virginia, won the contest, and he named the rover Perseverance. This was way before COVID was a thing, and so it turned out to be an extremely fitting name with all of the obstacles that JPL had to overcome to get it to the launch pad, and our nation and the world in general. And so recently we had a successful launch. Perseverance launched on top of an Atlas V rocket, and it is currently cruising through space right now on its way to Mars. It's set to land on the red planet on February 18th, 2021. So about a 7-month journey. And when it gets there, the Mars 2020 Perseverance rover will investigate a region of Mars called Jezero Crater. This crater is thought to have an ancient delta with an inlet and outlet path for water. So it's thought that this is a great place where we may find biosignatures, signs of ancient microbial life. And just throughout its investigation, Perseverance will collect samples of soil and rock and cache them on the surface for return to Earth by a future mission, which we've named the Mars Sample Return, or MSR. And so Perseverance is kind of like an upgraded Curiosity rover. The main body, the chassis, rover computers, remote sensing mast, and robotic arm have utilized the Mars Science Laboratory mission's heritage design. But there are a lot of new features and upgrades as well, including a whole new set of science instruments, a sample catching system, upgraded wheels, terrain relative navigation, and of course, upgraded flight software. So similar to Curiosity, Perseverance will be going through an entry, descent, and landing phase, which will utilize supersonic parachutes, a propulsive descent system, this slightly insane-looking sky crane maneuver, which actually uses a very strong set of line to lower the vehicle so that the propulsive descent rockets don't knock up too much dirt and rocks onto the rover, which could damage it. And lastly, we'll be using terrain relative navigation, and it'll be so crucial that we get this right because our landing site is by far one of the most dangerous that we'll ever attempt to land a rover. In Jezero Crater, there are mountains, there are cliffs, there are all these obstacles that the rover will have to avoid, all while trying to land safely on Mars. And this whole time during the EDL process, we'll have no way to communicate with it. It's completely autonomous. Even if we were to try to communicate with the rover, by the time we send a command, it would have already landed successfully or crashed by the time we receive a signal back. So entry, descent, and landing is known as the 7 minutes of terror for this very reason. It's by far the most dangerous part of the mission, and there are a million things that have to go right to make it work.
So wow. To touch a bit,
yeah, and you know, just to put it into perspective, some people forget that we've only landed 4 rovers on Mars so far. It's not like we're pros at this yet. And so we've done it successfully before, but there's a lot of things that can go wrong, and space is hard, and you know, we're trying our best, but it's still a very risky business.
Yeah, so much risk involved. Can someone follow along with the journey of Perseverance? Like, is there a website they can go to? How can they find out more when it's about to land?
Yeah, they can go to the JPL website. I can get you that link later. I don't know it off the top of my head.
Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes so people can click on it and go learn more about this amazing project that you're involved in.
Yeah. And on the main website, they do really go into each of the systems, and they have actually a 3D CAD model that you can actually click through, and you know, you can look at the entire rover. So it's really cool.
Well, I know what I'll be doing the rest of the day.
Yeah. It's super interesting. It's all public information, so anyone can look at it. And so just to kind of go back into the excitement of EDL, the new thing that Perseverance has that Curiosity does not is what we would call this terrain relative navigation. And so during the EDL, during the entry, descent, and landing process, after the parachutes have deployed, after the heat shield has popped off, we use a camera to capture images during the vehicle descent. And we compare these to the maps that we have of the landing site. So our flight software is designed to match these images up to the mapped out terrain features. And this is how the rover can make an automated determination of the rover's position relative to the terrain. And it will actually fire its thrusters to avoid cliffs or obstacles or mountains so that it lands safely. And so my current role at JPL is the MASS-CAMC instrument engineer and also the MASS-CAMC instrument operations engineer. MASS-CAMC is a optoelectrical set of camera heads connected to its own DEA or digital electronic assembly. I like to explain it as the eyes of the rover. So the rover kind of looks like a human. It has, you know, this long neck that we call the remote sensing mast. And then on top of that neck, we have 2 MASS-CAMC cameras. We have 2 engineering cameras. And then on the very top, we have a science instrument called SuperCam. And MASS-CAMC is kind of the workhorse of the science instruments. It'll constantly be taking workspace images, panoramas, and then our science team will see that and say, oh, that's a really interesting rock. I want to, you know, take the robotic arm and drill and take a sample of that rock there. So that's typically how it'll work in operations. And so before that, I was working on the testbed team, testing out all of these different Mars 2020 science instruments. And a test bed is kind of like the development testing area. It's where we test everything first. We push the hardware and software to the corner case limits, find all the issues, and then resolve them prior to doing the real thing on Mars. And so we're currently building what's called the Vehicle System Test Bed. That's essentially a copy here on Earth of the Mars rover. And so this Earth rover that we're building up will be used for full-scale system testing, including operational readiness tests, which are like the final dry run before you send the real sequence to Mars. So in the meantime, we have two other test beds, which do not look like rovers at all. They look like a bunch of electrical boxes and cables, if you didn't know what you're looking at. So the MSTB, or the Mission System Test Bed, is for testing launch, cruise, telecom, and fault protection systems. The FSWTB, or Flight System Test Bed, is for testing most of the science instruments, most anything with a mechanism, such as the remote sensing mast, which has SuperCam and MastCam Z on it, like I mentioned. The robotic arm, which has the drill and core, along with two more science instruments named Pixel and Sherlock. The test bed has the sample catching system, the core. All of these components are actually housed on what we call a hexapod, which is a giant structure that sort of, but not really, resembles a rover body, and it can be tilted to varying degrees to simulate different terrains. And so just to come back a bit more and talk about what I'm currently doing, as a MassCamZ instrument engineer, I'm supporting the principal investigator of MassCamZ, who's Jim Bell. And for those who don't know aerospace talk, principal investigator is basically the lead scientist. So I support the MassCamZ team, which consists of scientists and engineers at Malin Space Science Systems in San Diego, Arizona State University, and there are actually a lot of other locations where the full science team comes from, even including international locations like Copenhagen. And so I'm the link between all of these external engineers and scientists with JPL. We're currently wrapping up a big testing phase of the mission and moving into the operations, or phase E, part of the campaign. So I've completed most of my verification and validation testing, which is essentially saying, you know, we designed this component or this system, and now I've tested it thoroughly to verify the design and build is in accordance with our agreed upon requirements. And there are, of course, issues that we find. That's why we have a job. And in this phase of testing, it's typically flight software issues that we find. So those fixes will be put into the next build of flight software. And so the flight rover, Perseverance, is currently operating on what we would call cruise flight software. And upon landing on Mars, the rover will go through an initial checkout for the first few sols. Sol is a Martian day. And then we'll uplink the latest released version of the surface flight software at that time. So after VNV, or verification and validation testing, is complete, we'll move on to the operations portion of the campaign. So this includes all the prep work needed prior to sending the real sequences to Perseverance. We have different forms of operational readiness tests, or ORTs. So depending on different parts of the flight mission, we'll have different things that we want to dry run or try out. So one example is called SOX. This is also known as surface transition, and that covers when we first land on Mars, which will be sols 0 to 4. Another ORT that we're going to run through will cover a few nominal sols on Mars, or kind of a day in the life, if you will. We're going to have off-nominal ORTs, and when we have these off-nominal ORTs, there are actually going to be some folks that are going to create gremlins or problems, and we have to figure out what the problems are and how to solve them in real time. And this is all to prepare us for, you know, some of the worst case scenarios that we could see on Mars. And so upon landing, It's super exciting. And, you know, it's like building a Ferrari and then getting the chance to drive it. So we're starting to get the chance to drive it now. It's super fun.
Good. Are you nervous at all? Or with all the testing that you're doing, you feel confident in how it's going to play out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course I'm nervous, but don't focus on that. Just focus on what you need to do. I think the biggest thing that we have to worry about is just making sure that, you know, we're as complete as possible in our testing, that you're really thinking about, you know, all the requirements and what can go wrong. So that's the big part of, you know, these ORTs and VNV. It's easy to do like a nominal test just to check the box. But what's not easy is thinking of everything that can go wrong and making sure you're planning for that.
Where do you see your career going? Do you plan on staying in space technology? It kind of sounds like you are.
Yeah, probably. I was going to touch on also that when, you know, we do get the first images from Mars, that is public information. Like, we are doing this for NASA with them. And, you know, this, like, all of the late breaking images that we get on Mars can be seen if you just go on to the NASA website. So that's, you know, once I see that the images are public, I am going to be sure to be posting them myself.
Good, good. Well, we'll be looking for that.
And so I would say in the next 5 years or so, I do definitely want to stay with JPL. I mean, I love working here. I love the people I get to interact with and support. And just the missions that JPL has going on are quite literally redefining what possible really means. We have some of the best technology in the world. And as a company, JPL draws out, you know, today's leading scientists and engineers to work in its spacecraft. So there's just so much going on, so much to learn constantly. And so presently, there are probably two, you know, potential routes I could take. I could stay with Mars 2020 Perseverance in operations. I could continue to work with the MASS-QMC team as the payload downlink coordinator in operations, or potentially I could look to transition back into development for NASA's next flagship mission, which is called Europa Clipper. And Europa Clipper, that mission is planning to send an orbiter to scope out Europa, orbit Europa, which is the moon of Jupiter. And it's going to be looking for signs of life with its science instruments on board. And there are scientists that are fairly certain that Europa has an immense ocean, like more water than Earth does, underneath of its icy surface. And from time to time, the actual ice shifting has caused plumes of water to erupt from the surface of Europa. So it would be really cool to capture that. It would be really cool to see, you know, if there is the possibility for life, or if there was or is ancient life. And depending on what we find, depending on how much money we're able to get for future missions, there is a proposed future mission called Europa Lander, which will land on the surface of Europa and will actually take science observations in a targeted location looking for a signs of life. So again, this has never been done before. So it would be incredibly cool to do something like that. And for the Clipper mission, I want to say they're planning on launching 2024. So it's not that far away. And so we'll see what happens in the long term. I would say on a personal level, my fiance and I do want to go back to Hawaii. That's where he's from originally. And there doesn't really seem to be any step up after JPL, at least in the aerospace industry in Hawaii. But on the Big Island, there are the telescopes in Mauna Kea. There's also a large geothermal power plant. And there are a few options as far as tech is concerned. So we definitely want to, at the very least, retire there. But I know that ideally, we'd want to raise our future kids there as well. So again, we'll see. And who knows? I mean, maybe working remotely from Hawaii will be allowed as a new normal coming from this crazy pandemic. the JPL engineers already work remotely on MSL Curiosity. And of course, everyone is working remotely now. So who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, so many opportunities. It's really exciting. And I can't wait to see where your career goes.
Thanks.
Thanks so much, Kim, for coming on the Women Offshore podcast.
Yeah, thank you so, so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Before you go, here are some events on deck from my colleague Savannah at the Oil and Gas Global Network.
Happy New Year, everybody. It's Savannah from OGGN, and here are the events on deck for January 2021. This month, we only have 3 events, but if you'd like the full list, you can click the link in the show notes to sign up for our events newsletter. We send it out every month, and it includes more info about the events I talk about here. We even include events that occur 2 months ahead of time, so if you're interested in always staying in the loop about oil and gas events, make sure to check that out. First up, we have our 2 in-person events, the OCI East Houston Chapter Luncheon at the Monument Inn on the 5th, and the Houston Chapter Energy API meeting at the Petroleum Club on the 14th. The only online event we have this month is the Prefab Connect from the 26th to the 29th. Other than these events, OGGN may be hosting some more live streams this month, so make sure to check out our Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website for more information about any of the live streams we have coming up. If you have any questions about the events or any of our shows, make sure to reach out to me through my email in the show notes. That's all for January. I hope you guys have a great month, and thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in to the Women Offshore podcast. What did you think of the show? Leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts. Additionally, if you want to propel Women Offshore forward, please visit womenoffshore.org or womenoffshore.shop, make a donation, or purchase some swag. Until next time, stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.